From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from Eskenazi Health. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. On today's show, we'll encounter a son who inspired his mom to choose her career, a longtime musician who's inspiring new generations, and a Western art collection amassed by a major football team owner. We'll also meet Viking-inspired Andy D and hear how Tonic Ball comes together. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, we'll meet a longtime classical bassist who's generous in mentoring the next generation, learn how a son and mother inspire one another artistically, and we'll peek behind the scenes at how Tonic Ball is put together each year. We'll also discover how Andy D found his one-of-a-kind persona. But first, we'll learn about an extensive art collection put together over the lifetime of the owner of the Tennessee Titans. Yes, our Indianapolis Colts trounced the Tennessee Titans last week at Nashville's Nissan Stadium, but my next guest may make you have warm feelings for our friends to the South. You see, Bud Adams, who owned the Titans for years and co-founded the American Football League, had a decidedly non-sports side to his personality. This oil magnate honored his Cherokee ancestors with a spectacular and wide-ranging collection of art and artifacts, and after he died in 2013, the Eideljorg Museum learned that it was the beneficiary of Adams' collection. The museum's Johanna Bloom and Scott Shoemaker filled me in on this surprise gift. So, Johanna, welcome back to the show. Scott, welcome to town. I know you've been here about a year and a half.
Yes, thank you.
And what attracted you to the job at the Eideljorg?
Well, I've been involved with the Eideljorg for several years. So I'm a Miami. I'm a citizen of the Miami Nation, originally from here in Indiana. I was involved with one of the exhibits that was created in 2001.
Which one?
Mitosanyongi.
Oh, I love that. I can never pronounce it, but I loved that. People still talk about it.
Yeah. So it's a great introduction to Native peoples of Indiana. I'm also an artist, so I've been involved in demonstrating Miami ribbon work and lots of different things. So when it came up, the job came up, I was very excited about coming back home.
Perfect fit. Welcome back.
Yeah.
Kokomo is where I was born and raised.
Welcome back.
So one of the things that we don't talk about a lot in the media is collections that somebody is planning on leaving to a museum or another entity, a house museum sometimes. And that is what happened in this case. Now, how long has the Eideljorg known or had this arrangement for this collection?
Well, actually, the gift from the Adams family, from Bud Adams, was actually a bit of a surprise for us.
Because, oh, really?
We were not aware that he had intended to will his collection to us, so we didn't find out until... until he had passed and the folks who were handling the estate contacted us to inform us about the gift. And
that was a happy day.
Yeah, it was one of those, you know, really remarkable and exciting surprises. So we've been working with the family and with the collection for, 3 years now, maybe. It was 2013, 2014 about when we first were notified. So it's been... a couple years of work, you know, with the collection.
And you knew the donor before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody we were familiar with, and the collection was something we were familiar with. So
obviously, there's probably no way to find out exactly how this happened, but clearly your staff, the rigor you have on your curatorial staff, the high standards made an impression on this family.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So
well, and then the, Bud Adams has a connection to Indiana too. He went to the Culver Military Academy,
right?
And that was kind of how he became acquainted with the Eideljorg, was through an exhibit that the Idol Jorg hosted, I'm not sure what year, several years ago, on alumni from the Culver Military Academy. And so a lot of his, or some pieces from his collection were in that exhibit. So that was what kind of sparked that relationship there.
This is what sounds like a not only a deep but also a broad collection. Can you say a little bit about the parameters of the collection?
Sure. Yeah, the collection really covers two primary areas, sort of traditional Western painting and then, of course, Native American objects, which I don't know if you want to say anything more about the depth of that part of the collection.
Yeah. There is a wide breadth of objects from all over North America. And when I arrived, starting my job, the collection had just recently arrived, too. And so they were stored in this one of our small gallery spaces. And
what a treat for you as a
new
staff member.
Yeah. And it was like, you know, here you go. Here's your first project.
Wow.
So it seemed a little overwhelming at first. Boxes kind of stacked up to the ceiling. All over the room. And every day was kind of like Christmas, opening up each box and seeing what was inside and going through just everything that from Maliseet cradle board from the Northeast to Chittimacha baskets in the Southeast to extensive collection of things from the Plains region, Southwest pottery, Northern California basketry, things from all over. Mm-hmm. So it's very extensive.
Bud Adams has family history with the Cherokee Nation.
Right, yeah. So Bud Adams was a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, and his family's been very much involved in Cherokee politics. His uncle was the chief of the Cherokee Nation for several years in the mid-20th century. And so he was also an avid collector and supporter of contemporary Cherokee artists. So there's a portion of the collection that reflects that, too.
Mm-hmm. Is there sometimes people who collect know from the beginning they're going to make a big collection and they're absolutely disciplined about writing down everything, capturing everything about exactly where an artifact came from? Is that the case here? Is there pretty good material, or does this give you research to do?
Yeah, there was a lot of background research to do with this collection. There are certain records that
sure.
we did have access to, but capturing that provenance, that history of ownership of a piece and, you know, how it comes to be where it is in the present day, that takes a lot of digging, and there are a lot of gaps oftentimes. Mm-hmm. And that's not unique to the Adams collection by any means.
No, it gives you job security, among
exactly.
other things.
Right.
Well, the vast majority he got from different auctions, namely kind of Sotheby's and the bigger auction
Christie's houses.
And so we have the catalogs and some of the information related to that, but then you have to go back farther, and a lot of times that's very difficult, especially with Native objects, considering the circumstances under which those were removed from their communities of origin.
Were they ethically did they come into a collector's hands in an ethical and moral way? Right,
right, yeah. And, you know, and thinking of Native people during that era needing to sell these objects just to simply feed their families.
Mm-hmm.
And when a lot of these were collected, that collectors weren't necessarily interested in the exact person they got them from unless they were potentially
a
famous person
or
right,
yeah.
exactly. So a lot of that will really entail consulting with the tribal communities that they originally come from, that maybe there's different things that people can know about the objects that can tell us more about them.
Mm-hmm. Take me back to those days of opening boxes and looking at lists and going, oh, I'm going to this box next. What was the most hallelujah moment you had or wow moment you had in opening a box?
Well, there are quite a number of pieces on the painting side of the collection that were really exciting to uncover and to find out were coming to us. There's a really, really important Frederick Remington painting called A Buck Jumper that's a just a really incredible example of that artist's work. And it's interesting because we have a casting of the Bronco Buster in our collection as well, which is a really iconic Remington sculpture.
Right, I know.
And
it.
It's a very similar yeah. subject matter in a painting of, you know, a cowboy on a bucking horse.
Oh.
And you can kind of see as he's sort of working out these ideas and thinking about this icon that will become so associated with his own career. For me personally, I was particularly excited by a wonderful Thomas Moran painting of the Grand Canyon, which was actually just in our recent Grand Canyon exhibit, so it'll be coming back out of storage for the Adams Collection exhibit as well. And then, of course, the Taos paintings are a particular favorite of mine personally. So there's a beautiful, beautiful Oscar Burninghouse nocturne called Night of the Dance, which has horses in snow outside of a dance hall or something. It's just beautiful. And after conservation, it's even more glorious.
Johanna Bloom, Associate Curator of Western Art, and Scott Shoemaker, Thomas G. and Susan C. Hoback, Curator of Native American Art, History, and Culture at the Eitelsjörg Museum. Titan of the West, the Adams Collection of Western and Native American Art, opens November 12th and runs through February 5th of next year. Still to come on today's show, a Morristown resident figures out how to give her community access to fresh and local food. The New World Youth Orchestras provide incomparable opportunities for young musicians. Bassist Chantal Incandela recently spoke with Artistic Director Adam Bodoni and Bob Goodlett, Assistant Principal Bassist of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, about their November 6 concert and the concerto that Bob will be performing with them.
Adam, you are the conductor of New World Youth Symphony Orchestra. You also conduct orchestras at Purdue. You're a trombone player, but you actually have an interesting start with New World. You're not new to the organization.
That's right. I was in it as a high schooler, and it's still one of those transformative experiences that I've taken with me my entire life. So that's sort of, it keeps my passion reinvigorated daily, I think, because I can still feel, you know, being in that rehearsal room many years ago.
And now, as the artistic director, you're responsible for choosing repertoire mm-hmm. and running rehearsals. Choosing repertoire, I'm curious about the program you have in November. Tell us a bit about that program.
Sure. Well, on the very first rehearsal day, what I told the kids is, and what we try to do as musicians is always remember, why are we here? And it's for the joy of music. And so the first piece that comes to my mind is The Joy of Music is Beethoven 7. Just utter, complete joy. So we're programming that, and the musicians are just eating it up. They can't get enough of it, and I'm so glad they enjoy it. And we're also going to do a bass concerto by Dittersdorf, which is going to feature the assistant principal bassist of the Indianapolis Symphony, Bob Goodlett, who's also on our board of directors and has been for several years. And it's funny that the Dittersdorf came up, because we had talked about a couple pieces, but it's great because Dittersdorf is a contemporary of Beethoven, and we can hear how Dittersdorf did some amazing things, but he wasn't able to break free of form like Beethoven did. So hearing those pieces back to back will actually be interesting.
Bob, talk to us about the Dittersdorf. Not everybody knows his name, but bass players certainly do.
Bass players certainly do, and so do viola players. His name is actually Carl Ditters von Dittersdorf, and he was a contemporary of Haydn and Mozart and wrote in the early classical style. The interesting thing about this particular piece is it was written not for what we know as the modern double bass, but was for the Viennese bass, which was a five-string instrument and tuned differently than we tune our basses today. So it presents some problems for the modern bassist making it work. If you were to tune in the Viennese style, it is a bit easier to play. It's still not simple piece, but it lies much more conveniently for the player.
Adam, in rehearsing the Dittersdorf with the students of New World, this might be one of their first times playing a concerto, you know, accompanying a soloist. Does that change how you rehearse with them, how you talk to them about listening?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So people who have been in New World before, they're used to accompanying soloists. But for individuals who are new to the group, it is completely different. it's essentially, if there's a large 2D section, play louder. If you hear the soloist playing, please play as softly as you can play. It's almost that extreme sometimes. And the whole concept that becomes new to the young musician of listening to your music that you're producing, the sound you're producing, while simultaneously listening to someone else. I mean, that's new for the brain. And so it's a really great learning experience. But one thing I think they totally dig is collaboration. Like, they love that they've created something with someone else. Just having that one extra person in front of the stage is a really exciting process. And I like watching their faces when they see a professional soloist. You know, their eyes light up and they go, holy crap, that's amazing.
Especially the bass, too. I mean,
we don't often hear a bass soloist.
We don't get to hear it. We don't hear it anywhere near as often as, you know, we hear the violin or the cello. So I think that seems to be an extra treat.
One thing that young musicians have that Bob knows over and over is that they have just endless energy. You know, and they still have that joy of discovery. Like, when they nail something or it's completely together, you can just see how, like, that affects them right there in the moment. They're like, oh, classical music is awesome, and doing it together is awesome.
Chantal and Candela with Adam Bodoni and Bob Goodlett. The New World Youth Orchestras featuring Bob Goodlett will perform at the Hilbert Circle Theater on Sunday afternoon, November 6th at 5. Tickets are available through the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra box office. You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Later this hour, a tribute to a New York City disco night scene from the 1980s and an architect and sculptor turned music collaborator. But first, it's time for Eat, Drink, Indie. This week, Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Morristown resident Sherry Duggar, who saw the lack of fresh local food in her rural community and decided to do something about it.
First of all, tell me what the farm is and what you're doing with the farm store.
We are a Duggar Family Farm, and we have started up a farm store back in July of this year. We opened up our farm store. We had a grand opening. We are mainly selling Indiana foods. There's some stuff from Ohio and a couple of things that fall in there, but mostly it's Indiana-made foods. Raised here, made here by Indiana food makers, and we're just trying to promote local food in an area. We live in Morristown, Indiana, so there's not a lot of food options around here. So the idea was to bring in foods that are make it convenient for our neighbors to be able to get food whenever they need it, as well as to promote local food that's made in our state.
So how do you get to the point of opening a little store on your farm?
I think it was around March where I came up with the idea to, I was actually writing a grant. And so part of that grant application that I wrote, that I started writing in March, was to have this small food store. That was going to be the first step in this progress of all the things that we want to do. We want to have the small food store. We want to have a truck to be able to go out into food deserts and distribute this food and to be able to sell it. Hopefully we can create a community here on our property, as well as to be able to go out into the streets and get food made by Hoosiers and get it into the hands of Hoosiers who need it.
Now, I think people are fairly well aware of the problem of food deserts in the city, but food deserts exist out in rural areas as well, even though we're surrounded by corn and soybean fields.
Absolutely. I know that there is one main problem is that there's a lot of food insecurity in these rural areas. They don't have access to good food, good wholesome food out here. So in Morristown, for example, we don't have a real grocery store. We have the Dollar General.
Yeah, I think that's a little, you know, startling to realize that in the midst of the harvest bounty that is Indiana in the fall, there's, you know, food deserts right there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's sad, actually. And a lot of people, you know, the same problems you have in the city where they don't know how to cook the food. They don't know. They didn't grow up cooking the food. They didn't grow up eating the whole foods. So they have the same problems out here as well. They have an access problem. They have a use problem. They have a storage problem sometimes. So it's a lot of the same problems that you see in the urban areas.
So you can't just say, you know, everybody's got a backyard garden and they're all canning vegetables and that sort of thing. So that's an idealized vision of rural Indiana, probably.
Right. And I think it's an old one to a degree. A lot of people, I think it's coming back around for sure. But I think the idea that the people are doing those things is kind of past. So.
Now, you have been a writer along the way, an editor. How does that translate now into creating a different sort of lifestyle in the country and building a store and that sort of thing?
Well, I'm an editor, so I like to actually edit Farm Indiana. So we tell stories about farmers around Indiana in that publication. And that's kind of what I like to do, is to be able to tell people's stories, whether it's through storytelling in the store. I love having these conversations with people that come in and they actually ask about the food makers and they ask about what they're buying. So I like creating those conversations, whether it's in print, whether it's with somebody that walks into the door, and being able to tell those stories of what our fellow Hoosiers are doing.
So what are they doing? What are some of the products that you have in the store? And how have you built an inventory? I mean, you have a lot of stuff in a small space.
Small but mighty. It's been a learning process of going out and, you know, contacting people, looking at people who, like you, who post stuff on Facebook or online, and being able to find the people who are making these foods. And Tiny Footprint comes out here and delivers, and Piazza, I've become a customer of them as well. But it's also just having those conversations. I have people who walk in here and they're like, oh, I make this or I make that. And, you know, then we start having that conversation. I go to Troyer's, the Amish country store in Milroy. So there's a lot of different places where I spend my time driving and trying to find these places and trying to get more product in.
Did you expect this sort of thing to happen when you had this idea for a market at your house?
I don't think I knew what to expect. I think I just came up with the idea and said, honey, let's make a store. You know, it was a learning experience and being able to figure out, okay, this is what we need to do to set up the store and then hope for the best. You know, you don't know. I still don't know if it'll succeed 5 years from now or not. But our idea is, this is the first step in this larger plan that we have to build a community center out here, to build a workshop, to build a commercial kitchen, and to have a lot of things going on this property that helps people learn how to do things and helps them get a hold of the foods that will hopefully help our local food system grow in ways that it needs to.
Jolene Ketzenberger with Sherry Duggar. Hear Jolene's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. By day, Andy Duncan works a traditional job for a nonprofit, but when he and his wife hit the stage, they become Andy D and Anna Vision. The Greenwood couple just returned from 3 years of touring Europe with their self-described over-the-top homage to the New York City disco nightclub scene of the 80s. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer asked the couple to tell us what makes their show hard to describe but impossible to forget.
My halo is a disco ball. My halo is a disco ball.
Me dancing, you know, with the audience, with Victoria, us singing, our interchange, you know, audience participation, crowd interaction. Yeah, getting people to laugh, getting people to dance. But there's also that that element that, you know, even reached Indiana in the late 80s, early 90s with the kind of just positive hip-hop and, like, Afrocentric hip-hop, just bright colors, asymmetrical hairstyles, everything was big and bright, and just kind of that peacocking that was kind of lost at grunge. And I wanted to, like, bring that back a little bit and just, like, hey, let's just, I'm going to just wear what I wanted to wear when I was, like, 8 years old and see how people react to that. And they reacted pretty positively, actually, so.
The times when people laugh the most are actually when he has lines that are really, really good. Like, you know, the big one in Angels is, I like my movies like I like my women, short, low budget, and independent. I like my films like I like my ladies, funny, action-packed, and made in the 80s.
I like my movies like I like my women, short, low budget, and independent. I like my films like I like my ladies, funny, action-packed, and made in the 80s.
People more are laughing because they're like, wow, that is a really great turn of phrase. You know, so it's really not so out there or silly, really.
Yeah.
I think it's more just that people are surprised.
If you want to be here, I'm a growler. If you want to creep, baby, I'm a prowler. If you want a bear, I'm still a growler. Party where a woman will always be a howler.
I feel like I've used this before, but I'm a musician who uses humor to kind of get a point across, rather than a, like, musical comedy. And I like musical comedy. I just don't think I'm naturally inclined toward that. I'm more on the musical side that happens to use humor more like a humorist than a musical comedian. I mean, I love musical comedy. To keep the punchlines going that much is great. But hip-hop's always been about, or just all kinds of rapping has been about setup and punchline. Even rock and roll, I think, has, you know, punchlines in it and really funny turns of phrases. So I've just always been into that. Really what makes me laugh is absurdity. And I was like, you know what? I think with this music, I'm going to try and, you know, be kind of self-consciously absurd, you know, like absurd, but also self-aware, just to see if that's possible, if people can just like not dismiss it as clownish behavior or, you know, jaded irony or, you know, whatever else people kind of, you know, I want to challenge those kind of just lazy Gen X notions of what a guy with a rat tail and a mustache and a unicorn on his shirt and brightly colored pants rapping could mean.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that we hear the most after shows is, I love that because I didn't, that's what wasn't what I was expecting. And so that kind of goes back to what I was saying. Like the things that are the funniest are jokes where you don't quite know where, that you didn't expect them to go where they're going to go.
Right.
And that's kind of what, I guess, our performance is. Hey, there's a party in sight. You're shining bright.
You can hear Jill and Andy's entire conversation and Andy D's performance at wfyi.org/small studio. Local artist Sylvia Gray always wanted to be a painter. She loved the landscapes of the Impressionists and the detail of Disney illustrators, but it took her nearly 40 years and a push from her son to pursue her dream. And WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer learned more recently. What got you intrigued by this?
Well, you know what, Sharon? When you see Sylvia Gray's work, you can't believe that she ever doubted her talents.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she almost never pursued them, which would have been a horrible thing. She paints these beautiful, lush landscapes and these gorgeous hand-painted silk scarves and jackets. But you could really call her a reluctant artist because it really took some real-life lessons to enable her to pursue her own dream.
Well, I have a tremor. It's a natural tremor. And it made me afraid to do anything in front of people. It seemed like people would make fun of me, or I was afraid they were. And I was afraid to show my art also because I thought it was a gift and that you didn't have to work at it. But in time, I realized that you did have to work on art to get better. And it was something that I could improve on. I had an autistic son, and he was not shy. In fact, he would always ask people for things that he wanted, and I found that he would usually get them. And he did a lot of things that I thought were kind of embarrassing, but I realized that I lived through it, and if I could live through some of the things that he did, I would be able to do art in front of, I would be able to go to school and take art classes.
And Sean, it's kind of your fault that your mom is a great artist. What a wonderful thing you taught her. You like to create pottery?
Art class, yes.
You see the bowl. Mm-hmm. Go from nothing to become something.
Yes, and customers look at it. And the customers look at it, be like this one.
And Sylvia, how have you seen Sean change since he's been involved making the pottery?
It gave him a lot of self-confidence. His very first art fair, he was at the Indianapolis Arts Center, and he stood up on the table when he had one last piece, and he said to the crowd, this is my last piece. Come and buy it now. He sold everything. I did notice that when he was in a school environment, teachers always sent him into time out, or I would get phone calls about how he was misbehaving, or they would send him home. But when he would go to art camps, and when he took classes at the Indianapolis Art Center, no one complained about him. It was like they put up with his hyperactivity and his questions, and they always would tell me what a good student he was, and so that's kind of why I started thinking, oh, art must be the thing for him.
So what kind of bowls are you working on right now?
Big bowls and small bowls in Peggy's class.
And you also make installations.
Cups.
Well, you make some large pieces.
And cups.
With discs.
And cups.
Coffee cups.
And chalices, goblets. Mm-hmm. The priest did it. I make a priest a chalice for.
What items do you sell the most of?
Bowls.
Why do you think that is?
The customers like it.
And how has working through his journey through art affected your own personal journey through art as well?
Well, one thing I did learn from him is persistence. Because he is very tenacious and persistent. When he wants something, he will drive someone crazy till he gets it. And it was just a matter of being honest with myself. And I am a really honest person, and so I just let it go.
Sean is now 33 years old, and one of the best ways that he deals with his autism is making his pottery. That throwing with the wheel really does it for him. It calms him down.
Wow.
And inspires him. And he is quite the creator. He has his own website, SeanWare, SeanWare.com. And his work is available at Gallery 116 in Fishers, at Artifacts in Broad Ripple, at the Inspire Gallery in Carmel. Sylvia has her work up there at Inspire Gallery, too. And then she has her own website, SylviaGray.net. And it's G-R-A-Y. But you can also see her work, some of her abstract work, this Friday. It's first Friday, and all through the month of November, she's going to have her work up at the Indiana Landmarks, at the Landmark Center at 1201 Central. She and Von Biggs and Margot Dahl are all going to be there. So you can see part of her work.
And I love the title of the group show. It's Textured Shapes, Contemporary Abstract Artists in Indiana. And you are so right about the sensual quality of Sylvia's work. Thank goodness she does the textiles, because I don't think she'd be take too kindly to us going up and touching her paintings. But those scarves, they're amazing.
They feel as good as the color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I expect to see one of those in the not too distant. Okay, good.
Do.
You might need a friend for it.
I might.
So we talked about First Friday, but you know, there are some other things going on in the near future. Some of them still spooky things on that calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
Here is something kind of fun. There is, this is not Halloween related or particularly creepy, but it's a happy thing. The Indianapolis Jazz Foundation is doing a showcase coming up on November 17th. Actually, oddly enough, also at Indiana Landmark Center, but not in the gallery. And they're presenting scholarships to emerging artists and celebrating Indy's unique contribution to American jazz, which, as you know, has deep and long roots. Playing there will be members of the Indianapolis Jazz Collective, including Rob Dixon, Steve Ali, Kenny Phelps, and Nick Tucker, plus some of the young performers that they've been mentoring, talented high school students and jazz students from local universities as well. So that's all coming up on November 17th. It includes some cocktails and a dinner and a program. But what a great chance to see
the Jazz Futures is
the
what
jazz
that group
futures.
Is called.
Yeah.
And they're talented
they're
young musicians.
You won't believe they're just students.
Most of them are going on to music school, and I believe they're rewarding some people there that night too.
Exactly.
Tuesday, November 1st, first of all, in the afternoon at 2:30 at Ivy Tech, you can listen to Johnny Appleseed. He's going to be there
really?
Telling some tales.
Nice.
It's actually local actor Hank Finkham. It's at 2:30. It's a free presentation. They have an excellent restaurant there too at Ivy Tech Community College. You might want to hit that first before you go listen to Hank as Johnny Appleseed. And then that evening at the Irvington Library on East Washington Street, Dr. Leah Gunning Francis, she is the Dean of Faculty at the Christian Theological Seminary, and she is the author of it's an award-winning book. It's called Ferguson and Faith, and she and her family actually lived in St. Louis during the time of the Ferguson uprisings, and she and her husband, who was a minister, did a lot of outreach. And so she's written this amazing memoir of the people that took part in helping keep things calm there. And she's going to be doing a book signing and a presentation on Tuesday the 1st at Irvington Library on Washington Street from 6:30 to 8 o'clock at night.
Fantastic. Love it. Now, I don't know if you can still score a ticket for this, but tonight at 7:30 at Hilbert Circle Theater is the second annual Haunted Hilbert fundraising event. It's a fundraiser for the ISO. It's an over 21 Halloween party with mystery, masks, and music, and obviously alliteration. And it'll feature performances from ISO musicians and Q artistry actors throughout the evening. DJs Slater Hogan and John Larner will also be there. And food by, get this, Rocket 88 Donuts, Char Blue, Shoefly Public House, Psalms Tavern, Barefoot Wine and Bubbly, Republic National Distributing Company, Sun King Brewery, Monarch Beverage, and Supremacy. So some
lots
healthy stuff and some spirited stuff. Well, that's appropriate. It's a Halloween party. You may or may not still be able to get a ticket, but if you can, you'll be able to do it at IndianapolisSymphony.org.
Rocket 88's going out of business, too. Might be your last chance to get their
donuts. Absolutely.
Get there for that. And then November 4th and 5th, the first Friday weekend, the great guys over there at No No Strangers, it's the end of their two-year tenure at the Indianapolis Museum of Art.
Aww.
They usually present that Optical Popsicle, which is their visual variety show. But this year, they've written a musical. They said, we've always wanted to do it, and we've done it. It's called Heck Above Deck.
I love this.
And it's a story about an intergalactic cruise ship that gets hijacked. And you can find more information about Heck Above Deck at nonostranger.com.
So don't forget, this is the final weekend for the Heartland Film Festival, but still lots of great movies you can check on. Learn more at heartlandfilm.org.
It is First Friday on November the 4th at the Stutz, the Melody of Printmakers at the Madam Walker Theater. It's Art on the Avenue. And at Art Bank, photographer Faith Blackwell has her show Soul Purpose, and it's all about shoes. And so what woman can say no to that? So IDADA.org, it's the Indiana Downtown Artists and Dealers Association, put on their First Friday, November the 4th, 5 to 9 at various galleries all around town.
I love that. Well, there's lots more going on around town, both spirited things to do with Halloween and Day of the Dead, as well as things that are starting to anticipate those later holidays, which I'm not saying the name of them yet. But you'll hear lots more on our calendar next week that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. If you think tonic ball sounds like it might be a mystical source of better health, well, in a funny way, you're right. For 15 years, Tonic Ball has filled venues in Fountain Square with concerts devoted to covering the best bands of our time, all on one night, all for one cause, to raise money for Second Helpings and its mission to eliminate hunger. Impresarios Ken Honeywell and Matt Mays stopped in to tell me more. So, dear listeners, it's too late unless you went online weeks ago and got your tickets, or went in person weeks ago and got your tickets to attend the Tonic Ball this year. Congratulations. As we're having this conversation, you've just sold out this morning. What's your secret?
Apparently, my secret is Matt Mays. Because when I was in charge of it, that never happened.
Hardly. No, it's a great show. It's a heck of a lot of fun. We're 15 years, celebrating 15 years. So longevity, we work really hard to make it great, make it fun, make it a fun night in Fountain Square, get the best bands we can find in town. We work hard to go out and find some big acts, which we've done this year, which is nice. So it's all of those things.
Ken, take us back to the beginning. How did you come up with the name?
I actually didn't come up with the name. My friend Greg Perry came up with the name. We were just trying to find something unique, and it just had a ring to it, you know, and it had the word tonic had some application, we thought, not only in music and in just kind of the idea of being something soothing, which was, you know, something Second Helpings that we were, it was a tie to Second Helpings.
Sure.
And also it didn't hurt that we were having it in a bar. So the word tonic really worked, and the word ball just kind of sounded good on the end of it. And it caused some confusion for a number of years. We always got questions about what people should wear to the ball. And
aww,
we said, you know, blue jeans and T-shirts, maybe.
If you have clothes on, you're welcome.
That's expanded, absolutely, though. That is expanded. Some people are taking some liberties, which is a lot of fun.
Yes, yeah, that is true, too.
Tell me more about that.
Well, we started out in one room,
yeah,
Radio 15 years ago, and it's just grown and grown and grown.
And Radio is not a huge room.
No, there's a posted capacity, I'm pretty sure.
If you're a fire marshal, turn off your radio now.
Turn off
now.
Your radio, exactly. And then we expanded to the Fountain Square Theater a few years in. After that, we went across the street to the White Rabbit Cabaret. A couple years ago, we then added the Hi-Fi down in Virginia. And this year, for the first time, we will have a fifth venue, which is the Pioneer. So we've grown with Fountain Square, or vice versa, whatever you want to call it. And this year, we'll have 80 bands. And so they're from all kinds of different backgrounds. And I think, you know, to answer the question, some people really sort of embrace the fact that it's a fun and crazy night. It's a reunion for musicians. It's a great date night. It's all these different things. And so some people have a whole lot of fun with it. And you kind of never know what you're going to see.
Yeah. So take all those selfies and
yeah,
go
somebody
online
did,
with them.
Somebody at the Star did kind of like a Bill Cunningham type, the fashion of Tonic Ball, a couple of years ago.
Sweet.
And it was really fun.
Sweet. And you really do. You sort of invade and take over Fountain Square, which is awesome.
It's turned into that. We'll have 2,400 some odd people there this year.
I love it. Yeah. How do you decide on the bands?
As far as who
year
we celebrate, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the basic idea is that you pick a established, famous artist, and then we get a certain number of bands that come in the room and cover those artists. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 16 bands per club.
Mm-hmm.
So the first year, Ken, when they did it, they did Graham Parsons. And the second year, I think, was the Rolling Stones. And
Elvis Costello.
Excuse me, yes.
We were still saying, you know, staying a little more obscure, yeah, before we got to. Then we did Neil Young and the Stones.
That's right.
Next 2 years.
And so, and this year, as for the 15th anniversary, we're actually doing a best of. So we're doing the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, Prince, David Bowie, and the Grateful Dead, all rooms that we've done in the past that were very,
yeah,
successful. And how do we decide on them? It is a knockdown, drag out,
yeah,
case of beer meeting with the amongst the Tonic Committee, with a bunch of great people who've been involved.
You must have a waiting list of people who want to be on the committee.
Anyone
no
who wants to be should email us.
Please go to tonicindy.com. We are
and sign
always
up for next year.
Yes, we are actually short on stage volunteers this year. So.
Oh, so they could still get involved this year.
Actually, if you want to get into the show this year and you don't have a ticket and you want to volunteer to help us, you should probably get in touch with us.
Go to the secondhelpings.org website or tonicindy.com. We're always looking for great people.
Yep.
Favorite moment of this event each year?
Oh, go ahead.
Oh my gosh! Well, it's just amazing to me to I just kind of walk into the rooms these days and they're all packed and people are all having a great time and knowing where we came from, it just makes me smile every time to like see so many people in the Fountain Square Theater or the Hi-Fi. I couldn't get into the Hi-Fi last year, and while
what
I was a little irritated, I was also like really grinning about it.
Yeah, I think I have two answers. One is from the standpoint of that we're raising money to feed people. You know, we're raising money for second helpings, and we've gone from a respectable amount to a whole lot of money. You know, I mean, it costs very little to put this event on. So, you know, a small percentage goes to some operating costs, but it's a volunteer committee. The bars don't charge us rent. They just take the bar. We get to all the ticket costs, all the sponsorship money.
Right, and the bands are all donating their time as well.
Exactly. So that, from that standpoint, the fact that this has grown into something so large and has sort of, as we said earlier, grown with Fountain Square and hopefully been a part of the revival of that area. We're feeding people. All of these bands are having an absolute blast. Some of them are playing for the biggest crowd they're going to play to all year. That's a really great feeling that we're a part of something like that. And then the second answer is, selfishly, I get to play every year.
Right.
And it's just
so much fun. Right. We are going to have big fun this year.
Yes, we are.
Ken Honeywell and Matt Mays, two of the organizers behind the wildly successful Tonic Ball on November 18th, the Friday before Thanksgiving, starting at 7 p.m. This year, you can hear local bands cover Rolling Stones, David Bowie, Prince, The Beatles, and Grateful Dead tunes at venues throughout Fountain Square. The shows are sold out, but you might still be able to volunteer. Check it out at tonicindie.com, tonicindie.com. Up next, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long visits artist-musician collaborator Stuart Hyatt.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm in the studio with musician and artist Stuart Hyatt. Stuart is releasing a new album as part of his Fieldworks project. The LP is titled The Fair State, and it's based on themes relating to the Indiana Bicentennial, right, Stuart?
Yeah, it is.
And you have five songs picked out for us today to share, right?
Yes, and these have nothing to do with that record. But no when you problem. Asked when you asked me to pick five, I had about an hour to think about it. So
yeah.
Here they are.
What's your first song for us?
First song is In C by Terry Riley. I don't understand a lot of this early kind of minimalist instructional bass music. I learned about this probably in college. Didn't really like when I heard it performed. But it's the first piece to come out of that kind of 50s John Cage world where it actually has become listenable over the years for me. It's a series of instructions where a large ensemble will play different patterns. And for its 50th anniversary 2 years ago, it was recorded on Tradition Malian instruments. Have you heard this version?
Yeah, I love it.
It's gorgeous. It's just called NC Mali. Okay, second song. I'm basically connecting NC to another song that sounds like it. And it's by the Penguin Cafe Orchestra. It's called Era Dancer. And what this does for me, it's the same thing that NC does. It lets the listener create their own sounds over the music. It leaves space to invent a world. And that's just so important to me as a composer myself, is when music gives me the chance to kind of riff over it in my head. This one is called Center Man.
Oh, Center Man, where you gonna run to? Center Man, where you gonna run to?
It's a traditional gospel song without a clear author. It was recorded first in the 50s on some 45s. Even the Weavers did a version, but it was when Nina Simone recorded it. 64, 65. There's a couple live versions as well. She's my favorite American singer of all time, and this is like the ultimate mic drop. If I were a singer and I watched that when she performed it in 1965, it's like, why bother? Let's just end music. Like, there's no air left in the universe after this. It is extraordinary. Don't you see I need you rock? Lord, 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 on that day. So I ran to the river. It was bleeding around to the sea. Number four. This is a track called Arpeggiated Love by Axel Wilner, who records under the name The Field. And I'm actually working with him on my new record. So this is much more, you know, dance, electronic music. But it leaves the listener all this space to invent things. This is Arpeggiated Love.
Stuart Hyatt, what's your last track for us today?
Well, this is more of a personal one. This is meaningful to me because when I was a new parent, this was the only song that would make my son calm down. So I would put it on repeat over and over again. And he would be in my arm. He's a newborn. And this was the only song. So for all the new parents out there, put this on for your baby. It's called Sukura by Ali Farka Touré and Rai Cooter.
Joined by Stuart Hyatt, musician and artist. Stuart has a new album out as part of his Fieldworks project. It's called The Fair State, and it explores themes relating to the Indiana Bicentennial. The album's coming out November 7th, right, Stuart?
Yes.
And folks can pick it up at Luna Records?
Yes.
And they can go to stuarthyatt.org to learn more about you and teamrecords.org to learn more about the music you're creating and releasing as part of Fieldworks, right?
That's right. Thanks, Kyle.
Yeah, thank you for the awesome songs. Appreciate
it. All right.
It.
Kyle Long with Stuart Hyatt. Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for spending some time with The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today's contributors included Chantal and Candela, Melissa Davis, and Jill Dittmeyer. You can hear our program twice each week on 90.1 FM, Saturday mornings at 7 and Thursday evenings at 8. If you hear something you like and want to share, go to WFYI.org for our podcast. Tune in next week when we'll meet an artist who designs with guns, plie with City Ballet's Evening with the Stars, and talk with the winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant who'll be part of the Spirit and Place Festival's public conversation. We'll also celebrate when Indiana was young with Ensemble Voltaire and get to know some video game designers. And, of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.